Growing a small business has never been easy. So, how can we build our companies and shortcut the learning curve? By getting advice from the people who've done it before. Everything you need to grow your business is right here. I'm Simon Lader. Welcome to the conference room. Good afternoon and welcome to the conference room. I'm joined by Bob Cruz. Bob is the CEO and co-founder of seed-funded cybersecurity vendor Revelstoke. He is a graduate of Gonzaga University in Florence, Italy, and of the University of Southern California. He's had leadership positions with Symantec, FireEye, DTech Systems, and Demisto, who were acquired by Palo Alto Networks in 2019. And in 2020, he co-founded a stealth cybersecurity vendor who recently announced themselves on the world as Revelstoke. And I'm delighted to say that Bob has agreed to join us here in the conference room. Good afternoon, Bob, and welcome to the conference room.
Thank you, Simon. It's an absolute pleasure. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
That's a genuine pleasure. So every hero has an origin story, and you're the hero of our story. So tell me, how did you get from graduating the University of Southern California and Gonzaga University to heading up and co-founding your own stealth cybersecurity vendor?
Well, it's certainly been a journey, but I'd be remiss in not providing you with a couple of refinements in my bio. So Symantec acquired Bluecoats, where I was for about 5 years. And that was an excellent experience with lots of excellent people that I'm still in contact with. And then secondly, for USC, I attended some executive education there. I didn't actually graduate from USC. I went to Marshall School of Business there and did some executive finance and accounting.
So how did you get from being a foot soldier through to leading your own organization?
Yeah. So I would just say that from the start, you know, I always took risks and I always put myself into the fray, into the breach, as they say. But it was one of these things where if you have X amount of time on this earth, you might as well make it count. And not to sound too dramatic, but essentially, if I'm going to work 40, 50, 60, 80 hours a week, why not work for myself? So everything I did when I look back now from graduating college to today has all led up to starting this company. Every single experience contributed. And I guess the trick in that is when you're in that trajectory is taking a step back and reflecting and realizing that you're always learning something new and it's always something that you can reapply later. And almost more importantly, not every day is going to be a good day. And you have to endure and sometimes just outlast the competition and persevere.
Okay, great. So as you kind of built your career through sales and sales leadership, what point did you determine that? Because as we've talked about, you know, you've worked for a couple of smaller companies that got acquired by big ones, you know, like you said, Bluecoat being acquired by Symantec, Demisto being acquired by Palo Alto Networks. Yep. So at what point did you make the decision of, I'm not going to be a big company man. I'm not going to build my career towards being a big company guy. I'm actually going to go and start my own thing. At what point did that decision take place?
Yeah, I would say that it's ingrained in me. It's part of my DNA. Growing up in the family business, my dad started a Cruise tractor and equipment company in our backyard. And I was right there with him being his child labor.
It was still legal in those days.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a very scrappy bootstrap type of business. And so I observed that, I lived that. And when I entered the professional world and specifically tech sales, I started off somewhere where I know I could make a good name for myself and my bio and get some great training. So I started at Oracle, but I knew all along at the time Oracle was probably only 45,000 people. But I knew all along that the big company wasn't for me. And I was doing this experience so I could have the background and the credibility to get funding from investors for my own idea someday. So I knew it even then, back when I started right out of college, basically, that I wanted to run my own shop, my own business. And I would say it started with the family business.
Right. Wow. So do you feel then that the business owners, generally speaking, are kind of born, they're not necessarily made? Because that sounds to be your case.
No, I think that there's no blueprint. There's no linear path to where you end up. There's a lot of different ways to get there. It's just the way that it worked for me just seemed to work. But I truly think that if you're somebody that's willing to take a risk, not afraid of being wrong or having a bad day and working hard, then anybody can do it, really. It's the country we live in, really. So it's a privilege to be able to do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. So as you've developed your own career Okay. And to the point now where you've founded your own organization.
Yeah.
What do you feel have been the primary sort of building blocks that you've had to learn to be able to do?
Yeah. I mean, specific to me, I am a go-to-market leader. I'm a salesperson by nature, by trade. That's what I've always done, is sold. Related to your earlier question, knowing that I wanted to start my own company and get funding, I knew along my career path that I needed to get operational. And so, in fact, Blue Coat provided me, I had three or four different jobs there at Blue Coat, and some of those were operational jobs like sales operations. So to put it crudely, I needed to understand how the sausage was made and not just end up with a hermetically sealed package of sausages. I needed to understand how they got there. I realized that. That's weird. I've never used a sausage analogy before, but... But in any case, I knew I had to get operational. I knew I needed to understand how the engine worked in order to tune it, essentially. And starting my own company here, I've always been good at sales, pretty much always good at one thing. Now, as co-founder and CEO, I have to be good at a lot of different things, and I have to be operational. And one of the areas of improvement for me, and I reckon it'll always be an area of improvement for anybody in my role, but is just get a firm understanding of the financials, get a firm understanding of how that works and what not to do and best practices, and surround yourself with experts and mentors that know, have been through this before and understand that. But I would say that the operational skills is a key building block in understanding how, you know, quote to cash, how is a quote turn into a closed deal? What's the path it needs to take in an organization? And how does that work? What are the gross margins on this, that, or whatever, the customer acquisition costs? Just all sorts of SaaS metrics and things like that. I had no idea about it. I knew they were there, but I didn't really have to care about them. Right. Now I got to care about them. I actually dream about them at night, which is really sad, but that's the truth.
Right. I've talked to a lot of global VPs of sales, chief officers, some of whom have made the jump into sitting in the big chair. For example, with yourself, I'm sure you are a past master. And in fact, I know you are because you and I've worked together at hiring great salespeople, because that's a role that you've done yourself for many years, right? Whether it's been a sales guy, a sales manager, or managing managers across different regions and countries, whatever, right? But now you're sitting in a big chair and you have to hire a head of finance. You have to hire a head of production. You have to hire the guys who are actually going to make the product. I mean, you could write a book on how to find great salespeople, but how did you figure out what you needed to do to build a team of non-salespeople, the more operational people, whether it's, like you say, finance or production or all of the other things that go into building a successful company outside of your own specialty of sales?
Yeah, that's a great question. For a lot of the technical things, I rely on my co-founder, Josh McCarthy, who's an absolute genius and understands everything about coding and IT and layer 4 through 7, et cetera. And so yeah, I lean on experts. I surround myself with people that have expertise in their specific field. So Josh was a huge part of that for helping find our CTO and build out the team appropriately and in the right areas. Similarly with Nick Graves, and also another founding member of the team. So again, I think it's being able to, you know, be vulnerable enough to lean on other people for their advice and guidance and having to trust them. So I was fortunate enough to have these people in my life. For the other operational roles like finance, really leaned heavily on my investors and who are effectively my board. And I can't underscore the importance enough of getting the right investors with the right expertise. And it's not just money they offer you, it's expertise, experience, pattern matching, things like that, as well as their own networks of people like, you know, a CFO or something like that. So it's really just about surrounding yourself with good people who know good people, so you can back channel these people and just kind of figure it out and triangulate and understand that they're out there. It just takes a little bit of work to find them, but definitely lean on experts and mentors to help you through.
So how do you know, like, again, similar kind of question with sales guys, you'll know relatively quickly, in fact, probably very quickly, whether our sales guy's right or not, and whether or not you need to make a change.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, outside of your area of comfort, when you're stepping into having to be responsible for a whole raft of different areas of responsibility, how do you make those sorts of decisions in terms of, okay, we hired a finance guy, maybe he's not the right guy. How do you do that outside of your own area of expertise?
Yeah, I mean, it's a constant challenge. Again, I think about the financial folks that I know. I also have people in my role at other companies that I lean on as well. How did you do? I'm not afraid to ask questions. Be vulnerable. How did you find your CFO? What kind of qualities were you looking for? What do you think I should be looking for? You know, specific. Do you know this person? Were they any good? Did they throw the stapler? You know, what did they do? But it just takes a lot of human intel and a lot of legwork in terms of just talking to people. And it's amazing. And I've said this before, is that people love to help other people. You just got to ask. It's a compliment. It's actually a boost to their ego when you ask for their help, because it basically says that they know something you don't. They know something they can help you with. And people love to do that. I've been astonished that more people don't ask those questions. But in any case, I just would reach out to people. The great folks at peer company, adjacent companies like Strata, the COO there has been wonderful to talk to, and it would just help me. When I was at Demisto, the director or VP of finance at Netskope would just help me because I asked him. He didn't have any equity or financial gain. He just loved helping. And so I try to pay that forward and give it back to folks who need help as well. But, you know, if you want to consider me successful, that's been critical to where I've gotten today. And I know for a fact it'll continue to benefit me going forward. And just surrounding myself with good people, asking questions, not being afraid to be wrong or appearing dumb.
Right. Yeah. What would you say just on that has been the best single piece of advice that you've been given since being in the seat you're in now?
I would say deliver the bad news first. You know, to the board, definitely don't shy away from bad news and know that you're not always going to be right. Don't be afraid to be wrong. Things are going to fall out of the forecast or code's going to be buggy. Something like that's going to work, but don't let it get you down. It's very, very common. If it was easy, everybody'd be doing this. But I would say the single piece of advice is just persevere. Stick to your vision. Sometimes you have to suspend reality in order to do this because not everybody does this.
Right.
You know, it takes a lot. And I had a very well-paid job at Palo Alto and Equity. I walked away from to do this. And you just have to believe and not look back if you can help it.
So I'm going to go on to another question just to say, but just before I do, have there been any mornings when you woke up and gone, oh my God, why can't I be back at Palo Alto?
Yeah. And again, this is specifically your world. You know, I still get a lot of offers to run sales for a lot of money for, you know, CRO for a lot of different companies that I know well. And they look like they'd be a lot of fun to work for and it'd be an incredible experience. So I do have that. Like that pops up and I'm probably the lowest paid person right now in my company, but I do get these incredibly attractive offers and overtures for other opportunities. So yeah, I found myself going, wow, that, I could get a parking spot and that would be awesome, right? So, you know, that's the thing too, is like, oh, maybe there's some founders out there that said, I've never questioned what I was doing. I think it's essential to question what you're doing and how you're doing it, if you could do it better. And don't be fearful if you have a bit of self-doubt, because it's scary. Again, not everybody would do it. So just buckle your chin strap, because again, not every day is a good day.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I'd love for you to walk me through, whether if you like a genuine history or a history that's perhaps maybe a little airbrushed, but from the time when you came up with the idea of Revelstoke, okay, to go from idea to a company that is now kind of out there and announced, as it were, the kind of steps that you went through, whether it was getting a product, building an audience, or whether it was getting the funding. I mean, it just seems to the uninitiated. I mean, I've never built a software company before. How you go about from, I've got this idea, to several months or maybe even years later, to actually having a fully working, functional company that is now going to market. So what were the steps that you went through?
No, I can tell you exactly. So it was the last real RSA in 2019, right before the COVID wave hit. And I was with my co-founder, Josh. And we had left Palo Alto planning to never look back at doing security automation again. We were done with security automation. We were ready to do something else. The problem was, is that everybody we spoke to didn't want to talk about the new thing we were doing. They wanted to talk about automation. They kept dragging us back into this conversation, into this topic that we thought we were done with and put to bed. But so many end users and various people, they're like, yeah, okay, I get it. You're doing something new. Great. Anyway, so let's talk about automation. So I like to say we got pulled into this, because I was honestly reluctant. I figured automation was over.
So automation, just for background, automation was the piece that Demisto, the Palo Alto acquired. That's and that was the company that you were global head of sales. And you'd spent a couple of years talking about that to your customer base. And then having moved on from Palo Alto, you were talking about new things and people kept dragging you back and going, yeah, that's one and good. But what about this whole automation thing?
Yeah. What did you sell me? Why isn't it working the way I want it to? That kind of thing. But
right.
There weren't many angry customers, but it was definitely, you know, what I call demand pull. It's like an economic term, was there. People just wanted to keep talking about it and where they needed help. And it just became so blindingly obvious that we needed to do something. I like solving problems. And there was a very, very clear problem out there that needed to be solved. And so Josh and I looked at each other and just said, if not us, who? If not now, when? Let's put together a deck while we still have our day jobs, the new company. Let's put together a deck and see what kind of response we get. And this thing was ugly. I could have done a better deck with a crayon. But we just started going, not only, you know, I have obviously investor contacts, going to end user, validating things with end users, validating things with partners, and then validating things with some select investors that have been operational and automation for years.
So when you say validating, as in going to customers and saying, if we could do this, this, and this.
Yeah, there was recurring problem statements, which we can get into, but you know, we'd review these statements. We try, so again, back to pattern matching, we go, is this a problem for you? You know, number one through four. And they're, yep, all of them. Everything's a problem. So you kind of get down to kind of a recurring question theme and the pattern matches and it just becomes obvious from there. But obviously part of the trick is that we knew which questions to ask and who to ask and who to talk to. So we had all that, but it just became obvious we needed to create a solution to solve these problems that were still out there.
Right. So having identified the problem, what happened next?
Well, we did a bunch of diligence with investors. We did a lot of investor pitches and got to kiss some frogs out there and pitch a lot. We were pretty lucky in terms of who we knew to invest in us. And that was Jay Leek, who is at Clear Sky Ventures, is now with his own firm, Syn Ventures. Jay has invested. We will be the fourth automation company that he's invested in.
Oh, wow. So he knows the space.
Yes. And he's a former CISO from Blackstone. And actually, I met him at FireEye. He was my customer. But it just fell into place in terms of knowing the right person, knowing the investment, knowing the space, and having a level of trust and familiarity with each other.
So at that point, did you have a solution to the problem? Or was it purely, we've identified a problem and we believe we are able to solve the problem?
We identified the problems, but we did not. We had a PowerPoint. We had a PowerPoint, a really ugly one. And I don't even think we had a name for the company yet. It wasn't Revelstoke. And again, we went through a lot of diligence, almost like 4 to 6 months. See, that was February and our seed round closed in July. So yeah, we went through 4 or 5 months of diligence with 3 different investors, including Jay. And finally, we were able to close the seed round in July. But yeah, it just took a lot of legwork. I've never created so many PowerPoint slides and Excel tabs before in my entire life. But they also go dive into your personal background too. They want to make sure you're not like a felon or trafficking pangolins or something like that, you know, in your spare time.
So I'm just curious, like, how you feel about this on the basis that you and Josh had, you'd identified a problem, okay?
Yeah.
And you'd gone to investors to say, we've identified this problem. We believe that there's a way for us to fix it and to solve the problem, right, to the customer satisfaction. Don't know what that is yet, but we're pretty sure that that's the case, okay?
Yeah.
Weeks ago in the news was obviously the whole Terranaut story, okay, where Elizabeth Holmes kind of goes out to an investment community and she's going to be sentenced in July for serving time for defrauding investors, right?
Yeah.
Because she'd identified a problem. Obviously, she was saying that she'd solve the problem, right? So from your perspective as a CEO, where do you feel, and if you like guide potential CEOs that are listening to this now, how do you guide people to stay on the right side of the line where you're going to investors and saying, I've identified a problem. If you like, for one of us, your gut feel is that it's solvable. Bob, I've known you for a long time, and I know you wouldn't go asking for other people's money to be spending on something that you know, yeah, we're going to build a road from here to the moon. I mean, you're not going to do that, right? Yet at the same time, you still believe that it's solvable, yet you haven't solved it yet. So where do you feel, if you like, ethically, legally, sensibly, should people be thinking about drawing the line between the reality and the
position? It's an interesting question because you need to be extremely passionate and confident in your vision in order to convince people to give you money. You need to be credible, obviously, but you need to be very passionate. And like I said earlier, suspend reality in some cases for people to give you money. But there is a fine line there, right? Where if you're selling vaporware, that sort of thing, you will get in trouble. But that's where I also say, you know, picking the right investors and the investors picking the right people to invest in, because essentially it's a very, very personal relationship. They're entrusting you with the money of their partners and stuff like that, but you've got to be able to be brutally honest. And like I said earlier, run to problems. And when there's a problem, don't cover it up.
Right.
Don't try to gloss it over. I've fallen into that sometimes without realizing it. And because I try to be an optimist all the time, but that lead me to not necessarily sharing the worst of news. In some cases, investors only want to hear bad news. They don't want that sunshine all the time because they know it's not true. So I would just say, be brutally honest with yourself and your investors and start off that way. And, you know, one of the things I was going to say is under promise and over deliver, not the other way around. And I think if you look at Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, I empathize with her to a degree, but it's clear that she was over-promised promising and under delivering, and in some cases in malfeasance. So with my investors, with our investors, they know the space so well, we know each other so well, they can call any one of our design partners that's testing their product and find out what's happening, what's not. I think in the Theranos case, she had a lot of non-typical Silicon Valley investor types that didn't know how to do that or didn't know that they should do that. But clearly, again, there's a lot of hype there and people want to believe when things are too good to be true. They typically are.
Right.
So I knew our solution would work. We have the unfair advantage of having worked in this space before. We know who the customers are and why they buy it. I don't want to go over my skis too much, but we knew what the product market fit looked like. And so in terms of doing a startup and the risk level that we encountered is definitely high, but it's a little bit less that we're not inventing a new category. We're inventing a better mousetrap for an existing category.
So having raised the funds, then what happened?
This is an interesting part of the story I don't really talk about, but I don't know if my co-founder remembers, but I'm go-to-market, I'm a sales guy. I can't code VCR necessarily, right? So I don't know if anybody knows, remember those things, but I was just looking at this going, well, there's not going to be a product or anything for me to sell for quite a while. And we're going on 2 years right now, and I'm an extrovert, and I've been quarantined because of COVID. It's been a really hard stretch of time since we started this company for this extrovert. So I offered not to start right away. I said, well, great. I'm glad we were able to get funding and everything else like that. I'll join as CEO when the product's ready. And that was pretty naive of me. The investors were like, oh no, no way. No.
You'll have stuff to do.
Yeah. Not only really has, yeah, once you experience it, the pain / discomfort of being underpaid and overworked to get this thing going. And I was seeking to avoid that. And I can tell you right now, I'm glad I didn't. And it's been a wonderful learning experience. So essentially we just started hiring people, leaning heavily on my co-founder, Josh, because he's technical, and hiring a CTO, Dave McKinley, chief architect, Nick Graves, Richard Conley, some other folks that we know from the industry, and just started doing mock-ups and architecting what we think this should look like and how it should work and using different tools and all that stuff. And we're up to 4 or 5 patents now and a working product. And it's just amazing that it just came from a really crappy PowerPoint slide to actually an enterprise grade product today.
Was your focus just building what people refer to as like a minimum viable product?
Yes. I would say one of my mentors is the founder of a company, his name is Stefan Chenette, and he encouraged me to get the MVP out as soon as it's going to be ugly. It's going to be, you know, shooting sparks and dropping bolts on the ground, but you need to just get it out there, get it in people's hands. And I'm not a huge fan of having my customers be my beta clients, but these design partners love to work with you. I would say that's one of the key things that we should probably talk about is the design partners. They're critical for your success, and it's hard to find good ones, but when you do, you know it, and they really help you refine your product.
So what is the role of a design partner? Who are they and what role do they play?
Design partner is an actual, what would be a client someday. So you put together a profile of who your ideal client is, the size, the industry, et cetera. And then you go out and you get those design partners that resemble that profile. And they test the product and poke holes in it and maybe even put it in production because they're willing to. They do it knowing that they may or may not buy, but they're going to help the company succeed. And they're going to shape the product and the roadmap to fit and to suit their business. And so it's just a critical thing to have. And they're not easy to get because clearly time's money, especially for end users, especially in cybersecurity where there's not enough people already, not enough time already. So that's a really critical piece of the puzzle is getting design partners that match your customer criteria. And again, lucky for me, go-to-market person, you know, I have a lot of customer contacts. So that was one reason why it was good for me to stick around is because I was the face and name of the company and I could get these design partners to work with us.
So tell me about Revelstoke. What is the product and what does the company actually do? You talked a little bit about automation and this being a better mousetrap, but tell me more about it.
Yeah, we're solving a very human problem. First off, all good technology solves a real business problem. It's just not technology for the sake of technology. So The human problem we're solving is a massive gap in talent in cybersecurity. There's not enough people to hire and recruit, and there's only more product getting introduced to the market and more alerts. Meanwhile, the hackers are getting better at their job and they're increasing. So you have a perfect storm. You have too many products creating too many alerts. You have a ton of malware and hackers, and they're only getting more prolific and effective. There's 2 to 4 million open cybersecurity jobs today. So you don't have enough, that exposes your risk right there, the human factor, that you don't have enough people to operate the tools you have and look at the alerts and understand what they mean. So what do you do as an end user, as a company? We firmly believe and have experienced that automation and orchestration is the answer to that problem, is the solution to that problem. And what that means basically is an end user has 30 or 50 more different vendors to protect the company from hackers, but none of those vendors talk to each other. They're all made by different companies, Cisco, Palo Alto, CrowdStrike. They all hate each other. They're not going to work together. And they're all different screens. And so when you're looking at your cybersecurity people in your security operations center, your SOC, how do they manage all these different tools and actually effectively defend the company? So what we do is we make all those disparate vendors talk to each other and operate as one, much like a cockpit in an airplane. And so, you know, rather than, you know, controlling each of the four engines on your 747 individually, you can do it all in one spot. And that's what we do at a very high level.
That sounds great. Okay.
Yeah.
So what are the next challenges for you as CEO?
Scale, really. This is a ubiquitous problem. There's a lack of cybersecurity talent globally. And in every market, no matter how big or small a company you are. And it's not only in cybersecurity, it's in IT in general. And there's a ton of repetitive tasks out there. This is stripes across every single industry worldwide. So the challenge for me going forward is execution. Hiring the right people, attacking the right routes to market, like service providers, and doing all that. And I've done those things before, so I know how to do it and where to go and why. But yeah, that's really my challenge, is just execution and scale. And time is money, and you can't get yesterday back. So you have to minimize mistakes as much as possible and hire the right people for the right job and track it and measure it. Anything you can't measure can't be tracked. This is where it comes back down to the operational skills, where I know a lot of companies that have some of the most basic self-inflicted wounds, like unclear CRM strategy or an unclear channel strategy. We already know what we have for CRM. That's what we're using as our single source of truth. We're not going to have these internal battles and fights and data spread all over the place. We're going to be 100% channel company. There's not going to be an internal debate about that. We're not going to waste time about that. We understand how to do it and why. So there's a lot of things that, as a 50-year-old CEO and founder, I've already got the scar tissue from a lot of these things in my past. So I like to say, when you get older, you regret stuff before you do it. And that's where I'm at right now. And I'm definitely leveraging that knowledge and experience going forward. But it's all about execution going forward.
That's great stuff. What top three tips would you give to somebody who's about to embark on founding their own company? What are your top three tips to success?
Well, I would just say, number one, surround yourself with smart people. I know that's a kind of a Captain Obvious statement, but be brutally honest with yourself and understand where your strengths and weaknesses are. And again, that sounds pretty, you know, pedantic, but it's true. You need to understand, like, a lot of folks have so much confidence and passion about what they're doing. They don't listen to criticism or things they might've thought about from other people. They're not open to feedback. And you have to be. You have to be brutally honest with yourself and understand when it's time to cut bait on an idea and move forward. The other thing I would say is network as much as possible. I'm trying to think about this in terms of, I'm actually somewhat rare as a go-to-market CEO at this stage of company. Typically, I'd be more technical. Every company I've worked for, there's always a technical co-founder. But, you know, you need to get out there and network. And not to stereotype, but a lot of technical folks are a little more shy than somebody like me. But you've got to get out there and ask questions and network and build your family around you, you know, your work family. And then thirdly, I'd say always be raising money, part of that networking. And it's just amazing how much time, diligence, and raising money can take. So pitch everybody you can. You'll learn something every single time. You'll make a wider network and make sure the people that you actually end up with active investors, not just passive investors. I like investors like the ones I have, Jay Leek, Charles Beeler, and Matt Biggie. They're operational. They've done this before. So they're not just professional investors, you know, handing over a check. They've actually got real experience, or their network has real experience that I can leverage. And so that's critical, as picking the right investors.
So as much value in the dollars and cents they're handing over is their experience that you can turn to.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of money washing around out there, and you have to be very careful who you take it from, because you're going to be in bed with them for the life of the company, basically. And understand the value in taking money from one investor versus the other, because you're going to need help, and make sure they can provide it. You got to make triple sure they can provide it.
Okay, that's great. And Bob, how can people learn more about you and about Revelstoke?
You can go to our website, revelstoke.io, and we're on all social media channels and obviously on LinkedIn. So there's a lot there. We will have a free trial that you can check out and use. I think that people will be pretty impressed and like what they see. And then anybody who wants to can reach out to me directly and ask questions. As mentioned, I like helping just as much as anybody else, and a lot of people help me. So my email is just bob@revelstoke.io. If I can help, I will. that's how to learn more.
Great stuff. And I'll make sure that links to all those are posted in the show notes and go along with this podcast. Bob, thank you so much for this masterclass in founding a company. It's been amazing. The detail and the value that you've provided has just been absolutely fantastic. So I wish you and the Revelstoke every success, and just a genuine pleasure to have you on. Bob Cruz, thank you so much for coming into the conference room.
Thank you, Simon.
Coming up next week on the conference room, I'll be talking to franchise queen and CEO of Espresso Cafe, Nicolene El Haddad.
And if you think you're thinking bigger, then go to someone that's literally 2 to 3 years ahead of you and have loads of cups of coffee with these people and ask them, what do they do that actually inspires you to go after bigger? If you find someone in your niche, someone that's just been ahead of you 2, 3 years, it's more of a connection. You can actually say, I can do this because they've done that.
Thanks so much for listening. Make sure you visit our website, theconferenceroompodcast.com, where you can find all the show notes, plus links to the resources mentioned during the podcast. If you enjoyed listening to this, make sure you subscribe so that you're always the first to know when each episode is released. Also, please take the time to review the podcast so that more people who want to grow their businesses can find us. To talk about this or any other podcast, or in fact anything business related whatsoever, find me on Twitter at Simon Lader, or you can find me by searching for Simon Lader or Cilici Academy on Facebook or on LinkedIn. I'm always open to a conversation. Thanks for listening to The Conference Room. Until next time, keep talking.